going to read from Genesis chapter 37, starting in the 23rd verse of Genesis chapter 37. And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was upon him. And they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. This passage is a glimpse into the life of the children of Israel, the children of Israel whom God had promised would become a great nation that would be his people. But as we look at the lives of the children of Israel, as we look at this family set apart by God, we see a family that is in conflict and turmoil. This family, the state of this family, is a state of great conflict and turmoil. Some of the things that we read about Israel, the family of Israel, in the book of Genesis, we see that Jacob, who is also called Israel, he had two wives. These two wives were sisters, and there was great rivalry and conflict between them. This was exacerbated by the fact that Jacob preferred one of the wives over the other one. So there was, from that point forward, there was constant rivalry between these two sisters. Not only that, but Jacob would go on to have 13 children from four different women. And the conflict that existed between the sisters, between the women, would get passed on, would be reflected in the lives of the children, and conflict between one another. Some of the things that we see that happen in their lives that reflect the state of disarray that this family is in include the fact that two of the sons, Simeon and Levi, would kill violently practically a whole town of people. The eldest son, Reuben, would go in and he would sleep with one of his father's concubines. It's a scandalous story. It's a family that's in mess and disarray. And none of these causes of the conflict and the turmoil of this family are caused by Joseph. And yet, the hatred, the anger, and the envy of Joseph's brethren becomes directed at him. Joseph becomes like a lightning rod for the problems and the anger and the conflict that exists in this family. And from everything that we can see, Joseph is innocent of any of the causes of the problems that exist. Now, as strange as this may seem, this is actually a very common pattern in the history of mankind. We don't have to look very far in time, starting from the beginning, to find an example of this kind of thing. We see it first in the lives of Cain and Abel. Remember, Cain envied his brother Abel. Cain hated his brother Abel, and he put him to death. Was it because Abel had done anything wrong to Cain? No. Cain puts Abel to death. He places the anger and the wrath on Abel rather than answering for his own sin. See, Cain was not right with God. And he looks and he sees Abel, and he sees Abel is accepted with God. And so Cain, he projects his anger, his problems onto Abel, and he puts Abel to death rather than answering for his own sin, his own problems. This kind of thing is a pattern that we see again and again in history. We see it in the Bible. We also see it in many examples throughout history. One of the things that has happened in different cultures at different times is various forms of human sacrifice. In a human sacrifice, what happens is a group of people, for one reason or another, to appease their gods or to try to dispel the problems that come on their land, they would offer up another person, put them to death or bring them into some kind of suffering in order to bring relief to the people. There was a practice of this type that took place in ancient Greece. In one of the Marseille, one of the biggest, one of the most brilliant cities in ancient Greece, whenever they were afflicted with some kind of plague, they would select out one of the poorest, a man of one of the poorest classes, and they would set him apart for a sacrifice. An anthropologist describes this practice. It says, "For a whole year, he was maintained at the public expense, being fed on choice and pure food. At the expiry of the year, he was dressed in sacred garments, decked with holy branches, and led through the whole city, while prayers were uttered that all the evils of the people might fall on his head. He was then cast out of the city, or stoned to death, by the people outside the walls." That was an official ritual that they had. However, whether it was something that was an official ritual or not, this is the kind of thing that has happened again and again in history. It's come to be known by the term scapegoating. And this word actually comes from the Bible. It comes from Leviticus chapter 16. Here in Leviticus 16, God delivers to Moses and to the Israelites the practices for the sacrifices on the Day of Atonement. This is a day that God had set apart, which would signify to them the purging of their sins and their reconciliation with God. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered before the Lord and died. And the Lord said unto Moses, Speak unto Aaron thy brother, that he may come not at all times into the holy place within the veil, before the mercy seat which is upon the ark, that he die not. For I will appear in the cloud upon the mercy seat. Thus shall Aaron come into the holy place with a young bullock for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen coat, and he shall have the linen breeches upon his flesh, and shall be girded with a linen girdle, and with the linen mitre shall he be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore shall he wash his flesh in water, and so put them on. And he shall take of the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats for a sin offering, and one ram for a burnt offering. And Aaron shall offer his bullock of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make an atonement for himself and for his house. And he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And Aaron shall cast lots upon the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat. And Aaron shall bring the goat upon which the Lord's lot fell and offer him for a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make an atonement with him and to let him go for a scapegoat into the wilderness. And Aaron shall bring the bullock of the sin offering which is for himself and shall make an atonement for himself and for his house and shall kill the bullock of the sin offering which is for himself. And he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from off the altar before the Lord, and his hands full of sweet incense beaten small, and bring it within the veil. And he shall put the incense upon the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of the incense may cover the mercy seat that is upon the testimony, that he die not. And he shall take the blood of the bullock and sprinkle it with his finger upon the mercy seat eastward, and before the mercy seat shall he sprinkle the blood with his finger seven times. Then shall he kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people, and bring his blood within the veil, and do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bullock, and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. And he shall make an atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions and all their sins. And so shall he do for the tabernacle of the congregation that remaineth among them in the midst of their uncleanness. And there shall be no man in the tabernacle of the congregation when he goeth in to make an atonement in the holy place until he come out and have made an atonement for himself and for his household and for all the congregation of Israel. And he shall go out unto the altar that is before the Lord and make an atonement for it, and shall take of the blood of the bullock and of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar round about, and he shall sprinkle the blood upon it with his finger seven times and cleanse it and hallow it from uncleanness of the children of Israel. And when he hath made an end of reconciling the holy place and the tabernacle of the congregation of the altar, he shall bring the live goat, and Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat and confess over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions in all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat, and shall send him away by the hand of a fit man into the wilderness. And the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities unto a land not inhabited, and he shall let go the goat in the wilderness. Notice this ritual that God was giving to the children of Israel. One thing we observe as we look at the sacrifices in the book of Leviticus, in this chapter, in many places, we notice all the blood, all the sacrifice, all the shedding of blood and the putting to death of these animals. It was a bloody affair to be a priest in Israel. Here, though, in this sacrifice of the scapegoat, we see something demonstrated. It said that the priest would lay both his hands upon the head of this scapegoat, and he would confess all the sins of the people. The idea conveyed here is that this goat upon this animal was being put all of the sins of all of the people of Israel. And rather than suffering and judgment and punishment and affliction coming upon the nation, this goat would bear all of those sins and problems, and he would carry them away into a land not inhabited. One of the reasons, perhaps, that God gave them this ritual, one of the benefits of the sacrificial system, is that unlike what was taking place in all the other cultures of the world through different times, God provided a way that an animal would bear the suffering of the people rather than it being put on another man or woman. This is a benefit because this was something, human sacrifice, suffering of slaves, mistreatment of different groups of people, was something that was taking place all over the world. God allowed them to sacrifice animals in place of the sins of the people. Among other things, God created animals to symbolize and represent man. When Solomon writes his Proverbs, many times he refers to things that we can learn by observing animals. You can observe things just by watching the behaviors and the qualities of animals. You can learn things that apply not just to the animals, but things that are lessons for ourselves. Solomon teaches in the Proverbs, he says, consider the ants. He directs our minds to look at them, to watch their behavior, to look how diligently they labor. Well, this is because God has created many things in this creation to teach us things about ourselves. And animals symbolize and can represent men and women, can represent people. This is clear from the fact that God allowed animals to be sacrificed in the sacrificial system. So there was great benefit in this sacrificial system just in the fact that people were being spared because of what the animals were suffering. But far more important than that is what the sacrifice of the Day of Atonement, what the scapegoat, and what all the sacrifices pointed forward to, is that they pointed forward to the ultimate scapegoat of all. Coming to the New Testament, we find again, in a different form, the people of Israel in a state of great turmoil and conflict. There's civil unrest. There's conflict between different political factions within Israel. There's demonic affliction risen to a level that seems beyond anything we see at any other time in the history of the Bible. And everywhere that Jesus and the disciples go, they're casting out demons. This was a time of great affliction and trouble. But even more than all these things, this was a time when their iniquities, when their sin had brought them to a place where they were ripe for the judgment of God. Their continual breaking of God's covenant, their turning away from His word, their elevating their own traditions above what God had spoken in the scriptures. And we come to this time, and it's during this time, it's in this time of the New Testament, during the ministry of Jesus, when the high priest would stand up. It's recorded in John chapter 11, and he would declare, in John chapter 11, verse 50, "It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. It is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not." In this statement, he expresses well this mentality of setting up a scapegoat. This was what happened among Joseph and his brothers. Joseph was innocent. He was not the cause of the problems that had risen up in that family. He was not the cause of the turmoil. But their problems, their anger, their wrath, it gets directed into him. and he's made to suffer for it. Well, Caiaphas, the high priest, he expresses this kind of mentality. And in his mind, in his thinking, this is what was going on. You know, here comes Jesus, and Jesus is going around teaching, and Jesus' teaching was disturbing the peace of the leaders of the people, of the high priests, the Pharisees, the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, the leaders among the people. He was challenging them. He was stirring people up. He was causing people that would normally have been outcasts in society to receive comfort and hope and healing. And Caiaphas thinks that Jesus is the problem. Caiaphas thinks that if they can just make Jesus go away, then everything will be better. Everything will be all right. He says it's expedient for us that one man die for the people. That one man die for the people, that the whole nation perish not. He thinks that Jesus, perhaps because Jesus is stirring up all this trouble and Jesus is maybe going to cause the nation to come into conflict with Rome and destroy and bring about the destruction of the nation, he thinks if they can just put Jesus to death, their problems will be solved. But Jesus was not the problem. And Caiaphas did not understand the significance of what he was saying. When Caiaphas said those words, in his mind, he had one meaning in mind. Jesus is the problem. If we just get rid of Jesus, things will be all right. And I think Joseph's brethren thought something of the same thing. They thought, here comes Joseph. They envied him. They didn't like him. God had given him dreams that indicated that one day he was going to be risen up to a level of prominence. They didn't like that. They were envious of it. They didn't like that their father preferred him over them through no fault of his. And they thought, if we can just get rid of him, if we can just put him to death or even sell him away into another land, things can be better. And Caiaphas thinks, we just put Jesus to death, things will settle down, we can restore the peace of the land, and the nation will prosper. However, John reveals to us that what Caiaphas was saying actually had a deeper and more significant meaning than he even realized. He writes in verse 51, he says, "And this spake he not of himself." That is, what Caiaphas was saying, though he may have thought it was his bright idea, the words that came out of his mouth were really not originating with him, but God had inspired them. He says, "They were not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. And not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad." Jesus was not the cause of the problems among this people. He was innocent of those problems, but he was going to bear the sins and iniquities of the people upon himself in his death. Isaiah, the prophet, in the 53rd chapter, he describes for us the sufferings of Christ for the people. Beginning in the third verse, also prophesying of Jesus, Isaiah writes, "He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not." Here is the innocent, pure, righteous one, chosen of God, precious to God, God's beloved Son, in whom he is well pleased, in whom was found no sin. And yet the collective envy, anger, all the problems of the people are directed at him. They're there gathered together. They're shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" as he walks by. And maybe just for a moment, someone in the crowd catches his eye. They have to turn away their face. They can't look at him. It says, "We hid, as it were, our faces from him." Somewhere inside, they must have known something about this wasn't right. "Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth." Jesus fulfills what the scapegoat pointed to. God, in his mercy, places the sin, the iniquity of the people upon his head. And he bears it away. He carries it away into a land not inhabited. He carries it down into death, crucified on the cross. And then the story doesn't end there. But he rises again from the dead, showing triumphantly that God received that sacrifice. In his resurrection, his righteousness is vindicated. It's made clear that there was no cause of death found in him, and that God accepts the sacrifice of the pure and spotless Lamb. And in rising again, through his death and his victory over death, he accomplishes salvation for all those that believe in him. John expresses to us that deeper meaning when he says that Caiaphas didn't speak these things of himself. Caiaphas thought the death of Jesus would spare the nation from its temporal troubles, from its political problems, from its civil unrest. But God had a much greater purpose in mind. That was to save Israel. And not Israel alone, but all of God's people, from every kindred, nation, and tongue, from their sin. In conclusion, I want to go back again to Genesis and observe a few things about this account that's described for us. If you're familiar with the story of Joseph and his brethren, you know that Joseph being sold into slavery in Egypt is not by any means the end of the story. In fact, God was actually going to use Joseph's imprisonment, slavery, and affliction in Egypt as a means by which he would bring deliverance to the people of Israel. that he would bring deliverance from his brethren. That is, in many respects, the life of Joseph and his brethren in Israel typifies, signifies to us, foreshadows what Jesus would do in dying for his brethren. Joseph's brethren, in their hatred to him, they send him away. They send him off into Egypt, and he suffers affliction. But it ultimately worked together for the deliverance of Israel. In this passage, I want to notice a few things. Not only would God use this to bring about deliverance for Israel, but notice a few things about the language of this passage. It says, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, this is in verse 23 of Genesis 37, when Joseph was come to his brethren, they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was upon him. And they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now, I don't believe in the scriptures, which are inspired by the Holy Spirit, that God has put anything in there by accident. There's significance to the language of what's happening here. And I believe we can see in this passage that it signifies, although Joseph did not end up literally being put to death by his brethren, in God's purpose intervened, spared his life. But symbolically, there are many things here that signify his death and rising again. Notice that it describes him as going down into the pit and then coming up out of the pit. There's also, interestingly, when Joseph is sent to Egypt, he's carried there with these merchantmen who it says were bearing spicery, balm, and myrrh. And spicery, myrrh, these things were used in incense that were offered along when the priests were offering the sacrifices. We read about that in Exodus, in Leviticus 16, when we read about the sacrifice. Remember, the priest took the incense, and as the sacrifices are offering, incense would be offered up to God. These things were also used when embalming the bodies of the dead. Well, in this and many other ways, we see in the life, the afflictions, and the working of God in the life of Joseph, that it ultimately points us to Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, who would die, who would suffer, would die, and would rise again for the life of his people. May God bless you. Thank you.